studios of KPCW in Park City, it's This Green Earth, a weekly talk show about the environment and our connections with it. I'm Nell Larson.
And I'm Chris Cherniak. Utah Lake is a shallow, freshwater lake that covers nearly 150 square miles. The majority of its inflow comes from the Provo River, and the lake discharges into the Jordan River and eventually the Great Salt Lake.
It's a popular spot for boating and shoreline recreation, but for decades, large blooms of so-called blue-green algae have rendered the lake unappealing and at times harmful to native fish, birds, dogs, and humans alike. Even breathing the air downwind of this bloom can result in skin irritation and respiratory issues.
So why is this happening repeatedly in Utah Lake, and what are its sources? And why is this bloom sometimes referred to as blue-green algae and other times as cyanobacteria?
Joining us in the first part of the show to answer these and other questions on algae will be Ben Holcomb. Ben is the coordinator of Biological Assessment and Harmful Algal Blooms Program with the Utah Department of Environmental Quality. He'll help explain the science behind these blooms and the long-term outlook for Utah Lake.
Then in the second half of the show, Tanner Blackburn joins us to discuss what the company he works for, Property Management Associates, is doing to, well, manage their properties in a more environmentally mindful way.
They're implementing changes in their technology and behavior to reduce energy consumption, water consumption, and solid waste generation at one of the properties they manage, the Racquet Club Village. Tanner will provide the details on these measures and explain why these things are happening.
Exactly. We don't take phone calls during the show, but you can join in on today's discussion by posting your comments and questions to our Facebook page, KPCW This Green Earth. Our connections with and impacts upon the environment, that's what This Green Earth is all about. We'll be right back after these words from our underwriters.
Support for KPCW comes from Crandall Capital and New Park Town Center, with new retail spaces and a year-round community development. Information about New Park Town Center is available at 801-303-5440.
Join the Utah Symphony for a night at Box Coffee House with harpsichordist Jeanette Sorrell. This renowned sellout chamber performance is inspired by the lively coffeehouse concerts led by Bach in 18th century Germany. Enjoy the cherished music of Bach and his most admired colleagues in the beautiful setting of St. Mary's Church for an evening of rampant virtuosity. A night at Box Coffee House with the Utah Symphony, July 12th. For all Utah Symphony summer shows, visit DeerValleyMusicFestival.org. Utah Symphony Utah Opera is a nonprofit organization and a sponsor of KPCW.
Welcome to This Green Earth, a weekly talk show on environmental issues and concepts of sustainability. I'm Chris Cherniak.
I'm Nell Larson.
Well, Utah state and county officials continue to monitor a large mass of blue-green algae in Utah Lake. They're warning people to avoid a bloom that initially concentrated in Provo Bay, but now is spreading to other parts of the 150-square-mile lake. Cyanobacteria covered around 90% of Utah Lake at one point last year. This year, the bloom is getting started about 2 weeks earlier, and that makes state and county officials a bit uneasy. Is this the new norm for Utah Lake? And what is blue-green algae and cyanobacteria anyway? Joining us to explain some of the science and environmental impacts behind this issue is Ben Holcomb. He's the coordinator of Biological Assessment and Harmful Algal Bloom Programs with Water Quality Division of Utah Department of Environmental Quality. Ben, that covers both the front and back of your business card, I'm sure.
Yeah, it's an extraordinary amount. I'm wearing multiple hats the longer I stay here.
Well, thank you for taking the time to join us, Nell and I, this morning to talk about Utah Lake and the challenges it's facing with algal blooms. Let's start with a little more background about Utah Lake. We say it's one of the largest lakes in the state, naturally formed lakes in the state, 150 square miles or so. Give us a little additional information about the average depth of the lake, the inflow and the outflow of it.
Mm-hmm. Sure. I think it's been commonly referred to as like the largest lake in the West, but I've since looked this all up, and I think it comes in around the fourth or fifth in the West. So it greatly depends on how much water that's in there. I mean, mm-hmm. it's somewhat similar to the Great Salt Lake in that, you know, dry weather patterns through the years can greatly diminish the lake. And then we've also augmented the outlet so that we can actually pull out more water than what naturally flows out. So we have augmented it in a way, and I believe we've also augmented it so that it could hold a little bit more water as well. Hmm. So in terms of the inflows, it's primarily driven by the Provo River and the Spanish Fork Rivers. Those are probably the two largest inflows.
Right.
There's some smaller other creeks that go in, like Hobble Creek, and there's a Spring Creek in the southern part. But for the most part, it's those two larger water bodies.
And the lake is incredibly shallow, right?
Right.
It's not a deep lake.
Like you imagine.
Yeah, the other interesting aspect with Utah Lake is that it's, you know, maybe 12, 15 feet at the max. And I think
wow.
last year, you know, we were hard pressed to find areas to launch our buoys. And I think that requires at least 6-7 feet. So we did manage to get all of them launched last year, and it wasn't too much of an issue with being blown around the lake, but we got them launched anyways. And, you know, since then, we've had a pretty good snowpack, and it's brought the lake up to about 75% of its pool level.
Wow. So I guess that's just going to continue to rise through the summer?
I haven't looked recently, but I kind of suspect it's already reached its maximum, and it may be starting to decline.
Hmm.
There's water rights deliveries that are required, and so I believe they start that as soon as the irrigation season starts. They'll start drawing water out of Utah Lake.
Okay, so that kind of helps set the stage for why this lake experiences algal blooms. It's a large body. It's very shallow. It doesn't have a lot of inflows. It has maybe, what, one discharge point, the Jordan River. And so the water that goes in there and the nutrients, phosphorus, nitrogen, et cetera, can stay there for a long time?
Yeah, well, nitrogen can become aerialized or vaporized out through the atmosphere, but it can become part of the ecosystem and will continue to be cycled. And phosphorus, in the same way, is well, unlike nitrogen, I guess, is much more stable in the environment and much more likely to persist and cycle. So that is a critical piece to understand is the nutrient cycling in the lake.
Hmm. So that nutrient cycling, along with kind of the temperature and some other conditions, are what set up the set of conditions
yeah.
for the cyanobacteria, the blue-green algae. So just talk about maybe why these blooms are happening.
Well, we know that they've happened for quite a while, but there's also been observations in the past that it was a relatively clear lake. And I think it's probably a little of both. It was, you know, likely a water body where in the spring it had much more emergent vegetation than it does now, and it probably persisted further into the summer than it does now, the clear phase. But I suspect just because of the nature of the lake, of it being so shallow, it's much more susceptible to having the sediment stirred up and it becomes turbid. And so, you know, that kind of counter affects some of the clearer aspects of the lake. But I suspect it kind of persisted much longer through the year than it does now. I think one of the major turning points was when carp were introduced. They are every bit of a ecosystem disruptor into a new environment as we are. So it's difficult to say. I mean, and if you're putting carp and humans into a system, then you're kind of, it's a recipe for a big challenge.
What do carp do to ecosystems?
Well, so the carp, they target the vegetation, and it's been quite a while since there's been large patches of vegetation observed in Utah Lake. The Department of Natural Resources has undergone at least the last 6-7 years, I believe, on a carp removal project. They've been quite successful at that. I think they've removed the equivalent of about 100 blue whales worth of carp out of there, which is a phenomenal thing. I mean, we talk about nutrient cycling. There's been a lot of nutrients that have been removed through that process.
Right.
So it's still, we still have a long ways to go. And I think coupled with some of our other projects that we've got lined up, I think we can start making a little more headway on the lake.
What's done with the carp when they're harvested?
I'm not entirely sure. I know there was, they may be landfilled. They may be put into a bioreactor of some sort.
Right.
I'm not exactly sure. I know there was some, there was a lot of work put into trying to find a good home for these carp. But I'm not sure where that ended up.
Right. But the point is that they are removed permanently. And so their carbon, nitrogen, phosphorus that they carry with them is removed permanently out of that nutrient cycle. And that's the goal.
Yeah, they've been pulled out of that system, right.
Okay.
So it's got multiple benefits of, you know, shifting the fish community into a more diverse community. It's shifted the age structure of the carp, the age and size structure. So there's fewer but larger fish. So that's an important community ecology dynamics that have happened.
I've also read that carp not only eat vegetation, but they are very kind of disruptive to the bottom in general, and they stir up mud and muck, which then reduces the ability for light to get to the bottom, which further degrades vegetation growth, et cetera. So they're, for a number of reasons, they're a bad idea. Of course, we have why man introduced carp to the lake to begin with. Maybe it was to control vegetation, like so many times carp are introduced or catfish are introduced and things.
But, yeah, they may have been good intentions, but, you know, we didn't know all the consequences back then.
There you go. Well put, Ben. So let's talk a little, get back to the algae blooms. Algae love nitrogen, phosphorus, just like any plants in our gardens. We got to give them carbon, nitrogen, and phosphorus. Where is there excessive amounts of nitrogen and phosphorus coming into this lake, above normal, let's say?
Well, anytime you're a lake or water body is adjacent to a large urban area, that's a huge challenge. Mm-hmm. So we've got this large population next to this very shallow lake, even though it's large, but it's susceptible to these kind of conditions. So there's going to be inputs just due to our activities, whether it be stormwater runoff or agricultural activities or wastewater treatment facilities. Those are probably the top three things that are contributing to excess nutrients going into the water body. Yeah, certainly they're above a natural background.
And then temperature is another ingredient in these blooms as well, correct?
Yeah. So I think, you know, the lake has probably been just in this state of waiting. Like, it's been primed by our activities, adding these excess nutrients into the system, and now added to the fact that we're getting these, you know, year after year is warmer than the last. You know, that's another difficult challenge. Now, those are things that here at Water Quality, we can't affect those things. So, you know, our challenge is to be reducing the nutrients, the nutrient input as much as possible. That's one of the few things that we can hopefully influence on this system. But yeah, when the climate's changing, that's out of our hands, and the stage has already been set. So What we're seeing now is not just, hearing that these blooms have always been here, but I think what we're seeing is these blooms are getting worse every year. So
we're speaking with Ben Holcomb. He's the coordinator of biological assessment and harmful algal bloom programs at the Utah Department of Environmental Quality's Water Quality Division. We're speaking specifically about Utah Lake and the challenges it's facing kind of year in and year out with algal blooms and the growing size of these algal blooms. We'll get to the kind of the trends going forward in a little bit. But Ben, explain the difference, because sometimes you read articles that call this the blue-green algae, toxic blue-green algae. And then they, in the same article, they'll talk about cyanobacteria. Now, if I understand my biology, somewhat, algae and bacteria are kind of different things. What's going on here?
Yeah, this is one of those we have a hard time, I think as people we have a hard time letting go of some terms we've used. So, back, I don't know honestly when they changed the nomenclature, but, at some point, everything that was green out in the water was just called algae. Until a little more investigation occurred, and then they discovered, well, in fact, these particular organisms are a bacteria that they don't have a nucleus. And so everything that does have a nucleus and is a eukaryote, those are called algae. Like that term now scientifically has been it's just been left for algae. And then alternatively for the prokaryote, the bacteria, now this particular bacteria can produce its own energy through photosynthesis. So that's kind of the unique nature of these cyanobacteria.
And then they produce, the issue is not the bacteria themselves, it's a toxin, a liver toxin, microcystin that they produce. So tell us about what this toxin is and how it impacts people and wildlife and,
the
air quality.
Well, there's actually at least four broad categories of toxins. There's the microcystin that you mentioned, and then there's antitoxin, which is a neurotoxin. There's a saxitoxin, which is a type of neurotoxin, and then there's cylindrospermopsin, which is another type of hepatotoxin, liver toxin. They're continually discovering new toxin varieties that these cyanobacteria produce. It's fairly new in some sense, like we're still discovering some things. But in terms of just the toxins themselves, so for example, microcystin has I believe the latest I've heard is about 100 different congeners. So it has 100 different molecular structures.
Wow.
Of how it depending on the taxa that produces it. So, for example, we could use a mass spec to detect a very specific congener of microcystin, but we don't have a very good test to run 100 varieties of that. So can be very tricky to start testing for toxins just because of the different molecular structure they all have. Anymore, at least for a recreational standpoint, we're relying more on it's called an ELISA. It's an immuno response type of test. And so what it does, it looks at kind of a mammalian response to these toxins. And so we can put markers on those responses and measure that as a whole. So we can get a much more broader brush. But there's, of course, errors in that. It's not as precise, but it's definitely much more broad as opposed to like running a test through a mass spec, mm-hmm. which you're going to get that high precision, but then you are likely to miss many of those congeners. So in terms of like how it can affect recreation, if you're out there ingesting some of these organisms, and if they happen to be a toxin-producing bloom, you're going to be exposed to those. But the other tricky aspect is we don't know when or why some of these organisms produce a toxin. That's just the other mystery that's out there.
And I think Nell mentioned, too, that this toxin or variations of it can get into the atmosphere, too. So it could create respiratory issues, too, or skin irritation issues.
Yeah, there's been some literature on that. It's tougher to quantify. They've done nasal swabs on skiers and so on, and they've detected microcystin in their system, in their nasal passageway, but it's not yet clear on what is a risk level. So the higher risk is mostly with children, probably from the ages of like 6 to 12,
right?
Because they tend to be more active, and if they are out there playing, they tend to swallow more water than an adult, plus they're smaller.
Sure.
So our thresholds tend to target that group.
Okay. Couple more minutes. And so what's the extent of the bloom right now?
Yesterday I got an image from the satellite from NOAA and NASA, and part of the lake was covered with clouds, so I couldn't tell for sure, but the image the day before showed that it covered probably, I'm guessing, at least 85% of the lake.
Wow.
Now, it's difficult to say, on the fringes of the bloom, which, you know, comprises a large extent of the bloom, you know, what those concentrations are. So we're going out today, and we're going to collect some more samples throughout the lake. But there's definitely an increase in the concentration in certain areas. And that was, even though there was some cloud cover, I could see a good part of the lake, and it's definitely becoming more dense in certain areas. So we'll be targeting those spots as well. We're not having great, I mean, the cyanobacteria are receiving great weather for
right.
their condition. It's not helpful for us. It's just been hot and fairly calm. We haven't had really many storm systems move in to kind of disrupt things. It's really just, it's kind of, they're really in their heyday right now.
Right.
So.
So before we let you go, last year I remember during this algal bloom, there was a lot of question and confusion around using this water for other purposes, like to water your lawn or to put on crops. Some of these might be edible, or, you know, eating like seafood, you know, eating fish or something
right.
caught from the lake. So where do we stand on those topics now?
Well, it's still a largely unanswered question. It's a question we've posed nationally quite a bit. And I think we're a little more, I think we were much more cautious last year because there was just so little known. But I think knowing now that so far this bloom hasn't produced that high of toxin levels, that generally what you're using on your garden and so forth, it should be fine. But the Department of Ag and Food now have a program in place where they're helping us collect some information, and they'll be keeping an eye on those kind of conditions. In terms of the fishery aspect, so far what I've been reading is that, you know, as long as you clean your fish well, don't use the lake water, of course, and discard the guts, it's generally pretty good. Because we're not having a persistent yearly bloom, those tend to be the water bodies where they'll can accumulate in the fish tissue, whereas ours is more of a seasonal aspect. And then on top of it, when ours is seasonal, it's generally not a high toxin type of bloom. So for the most part, our fish should be safe to eat.
Oh, okay. So
if you're willing to risk
okay.
it.
Okay.
We'll be following up on some tests probably later this year. We want to take some fish when the bloom does become toxic. So we're keeping an eye on when those conditions change, and we want to, like, kind of pick out the worst case scenario. But for the most part, what other researchers are finding across the nation is that fish tissue levels are safe for these seasonal waters.
Okay. My final question is this an intractable problem? I mean, it's been going on for years. Summertime blooms. You say these are seasonal events, but is this just the new norm for Utah Lake?
Yeah, I don't know if anything's going to be normal anymore. I don't know if there's a new norm. I think everything's still going to be. I think we're just going to go through a lot of chaos in our natural environment for quite a while. So I think it could be worse on some years, and it might be better on some years. I think definitely the one takeaway is that we can't just sit by and do nothing. So I think we want to be more proactive on and more aggressive on our nutrient reduction, and because that's, you know, we can't just continue with the same, because you know, if the weather continues to get warmer, it's only going to respond. If you want to see some worse examples, just look to China. Their lakes are going gangbusters with cyanobacteria now,
right,
because they're in the same condition, but some of their lakes bloom year-round. Now, we haven't warmed to that extent yet, mm-hmm, but that's not out of the question.
Right. So part of the answer here is reducing the amount of nitrogen and phosphorus that gets introduced into the lake, like you say, via non-point sources. Point sources being, say, wastewater treatment plant effluent, non-point sources being farming operations, homeowners who over-fertilize their lawn, things like that.
Yep, it's going to take everybody's effort to, it's going to have to be everybody's effort to think about where their nutrients go. But it's a hard concept for people to understand, because mm-hmm, nutrients tend to be thought of as a good thing. But in this case,
right,
it's too much of a good thing. Kind of Utah Lake on too much sugar, and it's got diabetes.
So, I like that.
I like
back
that.
To sugar.
Perfect. Well, so where can people go to learn more about Utah Lake and its diabetes-like conditions? You have a website?
Yeah, we've got a couple different places for you to look. For our harmful algal bloom advisories, you can go to habs.utah.gov. And then from there, we've got links to our nutrient reduction program that highlights a number of our different efforts and explains what our priorities are going to be going forward.
And I just got a text from a listener who wants to know, are there other lakes at risk?
Well, there was a Schofield Reservoir last year that had a really bad problem. It had, a fish kill. There was bat deaths associated with this as well.
Right. Wow.
So that was a particularly toxic bloom. And unfortunately, that's also the source water for the city of Price. Now, the drinking water provider there was well aware and prepared for these kind of events. So that's the fortunate side. The unfortunate side is that, you know, they've got to put that kind of expense towards treating the water. So, it's one of that old time saying, like, an ounce of prevention is a pound of cure. So that's another area, though, that we need to focus some efforts on nutrient reduction.
All right. We'll have to leave it at that, and I think we'll get in touch with you again. Maybe once the bloom is over, we'll get an update from you on some of your ongoing science and research in this area.
Sure, that'd be great.
Ben Holcomb is the coordinator of biological assessment and harmful algal bloom programs, the Utah Department of Environmental Quality's Water Quality Division. Ben, thanks again for joining us this morning on This Green Earth.
Sure thing. Thank you very much.
All right, let's take a break for some underwriters. Sponsors.
That's right. And then it's time to come back and talk about sustainability and property management with Tanner Blackburn.
It's This Green Earth. We'll be right back.
This is Brenda with Republic Services, your local provider for recycling and garbage collection. Information about what is acceptable to put in your curbside recycling bin can be found at summitcountyrecycles.org. Please help Summit County be clean. Remember to recycle.
Hi, I'm Tom Pettigrew from Park City Mountain and a proud supporter of KPCW. From kids' rope courses to zip lines and hiking trails to the bike park, Park City offers a wide range of family-friendly activities all summer long. More information on new summer activities and all the other programs can be found at parkcitymountain.com.
Hi, this is Dr. Juliana Miller from Miller Orthodontics, a proud supporter of The Local View with Randy Barton. With a combined 45 years of orthodontic experience, my husband and I are now raising our family and working full-time in the Park City community. There are so many reasons to smile in Park City. More information at m2ortho.com.
Welcome back to This Green Earth, a weekly talk show on environmental issues and concepts of sustainability. I'm Chris Cherniak.
I'm Nell Larson.
And joining us in the studio is Tanner Blackburn. He is with Property Management Associates. Heretofore, we will just call you PMA.
Okay.
We accompany you with. And you're here to talk a little bit about what PMA is doing with respect to, say, environmental stewardship, concepts of sustainability, right?
Right.
First, what's your title at PMA?
I'm general manager of PMA.
General manager. How long have you been there?
I've been with PMA for about 2 years now. And in the industry, I've been there for about 9 years.
Okay. And what does PMA do?
PMA is a property management company. We assist HOAs in the management of their property, collection of the funds that owners are obligated to pay, and then the investments of those funds to maintain the property as well as improve it.
All right. And now I happen to live at Racquet Club Village, of which PMA is our property manager. So that's why I invited you on versus other property managers. Well, welcome to hear from other property management associations, businesses who want to come on and share what they're doing, too. We'll get to that in a little bit. But, you know, our community tries to be environmentally aware, good stewards of the environment. We're looking at after the energy we use, consume, the water we consume, our landscaping habits, our driving habits, et cetera. What is PMA doing to be better stewards of the environment? Let's go like tick off the list with respect to, say, electricity and natural gas use, if there is any, at, say, Racquet Club Village.
Well, at Racquet Club Village, you don't have any natural gas that's paid through the HOA fee.
Right, so we don't have giant flames coming out.
Right. And off-gassing.
Like some hotels we know around that are just burning natural gas fireplaces outdoors. We don't have that at PM. And I don't think we ever will have it at Racquet Club Village. So we're good with the natural gas. Mm-hmm. Electricity.
Electricity, you have a lot of common area lighting, specifically in front of those garages. And we recently had all the light bulbs replaced in front of those garages.
Right.
We worked with a company called Super Green Solutions to help invest in these. Yeah, great
title.
Very
clear-cut
name.
Great title,
exactly.
Say exactly what they do.
Super Green.
We don't want there to be any question there.
Then no question.
We worked through them with Rocky Mountain Power as well because Rocky Mountain offers rebates for residents that are trying to be green. And so we invested what was equivalent to $3,200 in LED light bulbs for a total of just under $1,000 because of Rocky Mountain rebates.
Wow.
So not only do you have an incentivized program in place to conserve, because otherwise someone's not going to want to go out and buy a bunch of LED light bulbs that are ultimately going to save power.
Right.
You know, when you want to feel the savings now. And so Rocky Mountain Power has been good about offering something by way of a rebate.
So that's over 50% savings. $3,200 worth of LED bulbs,
right?
That ultimately only cost you $1,000 because of Rocky Mountain Power's savings initiatives or programs.
Yeah, absolutely.
All right. So how many light bulbs was that?
It was
well, a couple per garage.
Yeah, and 100 and... we're talking probably 220 light bulbs that we put in.
So now we all have LED. All of our external lighting is LED based.
For the garages. Owners maintain their own lighting around the porches.
Yeah.
So they're welcome to switch that out, but the HOA maintains the lights by the garages.
Okay. And so you're going to see saving you slash we, as the homeowners, are going to see savings in our lower electricity cost associated with that lighting.
Absolutely.
Okay. Anything else with respect to electric? I got one. Of course, our irrigation system has electricity associated with it because we're running pumps and things like that. What's being done with respect to that? That's a big one.
Yeah.
Because that's a whole landscaping issue. But first, just the electricity side of running that irrigation system.
It's quite efficient. 6 years ago, Racquet Club Village overhauled their entire irrigation system, which included installing new clocks on the property. And those clocks specifically, it removed a total of, I think, 10 clocks at the property. And now there's only three.
Three clocks. All right. Explain that.
Those clocks, that's where you select the time frames in which irrigation is going to run, the amount of time, and you're able to monitor if there are electrical issues. It's an upgraded clock, and it certainly costs the association to make that, but maintaining it and being able to access that clock digitally was an element of why the association wanted to make such a move.
So I'm curious about, before we get too much further into the different things you guys are doing, what sort of has motivated these changes? Is it just Christopher Cherniak making complaints and
standing out on
waving
his
arms and begging yelling for LED lights? is it the general consensus among the residents, or is it economically driven?
Originally, from your end. Originally, it would have been economically driven. Racquet Club Village, tied to the water element of things, was spending exorbitant amount of money.
It was our largest line item.
Oh, yeah.
It's, we'd say our line item, landscaping or so. Water. Water was our largest
line
item. So.
So there was an economic drive to wanting to make that change. You know, having the foresight to recognize that water costs are only going to go up in this town. And we know that's not going to change anytime soon. Go to a city council meeting, and there's probably a conversation about it. So that was the main driving force. And then there became a recognition of, hey, there's other areas where we can really save money. You know, how much are we spending replacing light bulbs every year that go out on these garages? LED lasts longer, and it's more energy efficient.
And it's a brighter light.
Absolutely.
At night. It's a much whiter light. Some people actually find it somewhat of annoying, but it's a brighter, it casts a much brighter light. For security reasons, that's great.
Right. And 5 years ago, you know, when you bought LED bulbs, you had, your choice was bright white or that's it.
Yeah.
Or you go with an incandescent bulb. And now it's changed. And so you're able to say, I want a warm light LED bulb. And that's the direction we opted to go.
All right. So it, driven by economics, maybe some of the HOA members were see the value in promoting better environmental storage. Let's be honest. Racquet Club Village grows acres and acres and acres of Kentucky bluegrass. That drives me bananas. And I think we're making efforts there to try to reduce that amount of grass, because every blade of grass we grow requires water, which requires energy, and then someone has to mow it and whack it and then blow it to kingdom come or into my car.
Yeah.
We've already talked, which I find a tremendous waste of fuel and energy. And then it has to be, what else? Now, fertilized. It has to be fertilized.
Oh, yeah, I'm sure there's, you know, if there's herbicides, pesticides,
and we had our vole problem, they had to be rodent-sided. So there's no good reason, compelling reason in my mind, that we should be growing as much Kentucky bluegrass. And I think there should be efforts afoot to reduce the amount. Are you guys looking into that?
Yeah, okay. We've been working closely with the board to review what we can do at the property to cut back on the grass. Because let's be honest, there's a lot of areas where there's grass and no one's out there having picnics. Otherwise, what's the point of it? And so we've been in touch with a horticulturist to give us some direction on where can we afford to cut back on grass and put more of a natural growth area in place. that is water efficient. It's natural to this climate.
Right. Better for pollinators.
Exactly.
Because bees and butterflies, Kentucky bluegrass to a bee and butterfly is flyover country. That's mm-hmm. all it is. It's just flying over from this flower to that flower. So the more that we can reduce our grass, and I say we, everybody in this town can reduce the amount of grass they grow and replace it with native species like, what now, Russian sage, verbena?
Native plants or native grass? Because another interesting thing is there are native grasses that can be used as turf grasses. They don't tend to stay green as long, which is why they sometimes cause problems with, like, HOAs, frankly, with HOA. I've had people come to me and say, like, well, I tried this native grass and I loved it, but, you know, it turned brown before my neighbor's lawns and therefore it became an issue.
Yeah, and I was, I was shamed.
Shamed and told that I had to
stay inside.
My house was graffitied. No. But it does. These things cause incredible issues, right? And so the grass is tough. But yeah, there are tons and tons of native plant species that are, you know, a drought tolerant, that really don't need much water at all, which is incredible, that also have beautiful flowers to attract those native species. We were talking about birds and butterflies and pollinators.
All right. So we don't want to run, and I run away with the conversation.
Yeah, exactly.
But you get it, Tanner. And, and I think PMA is trying to do its best to address the amount of grass we're doing. And so we're mulching and rocking more beneath trees. We're not growing grass under trees.
Right.
That's useless. That's harmful to, that's bad for the tree. Mm-hmm. So, and we're going to try to plant more native species. We've done a wonderful job landscaping the front, the entryways, and I'd like to see more of that. Forward.
And that's the intent, is to move through the property and keep that same theme that can hold water longer.
Okay.
So, Tanner, I'm curious, you know, you guys are doing a ton with the Racquet Club area. Are your other clients interested in these same types of things? Like, is this an outlier or is it a trend that you're seeing where people want to do, you know, water-wise or energy-efficient, sustainable, you know, initiatives?
Initially, Racquet Club was an outlier, but the interest level has increased just with the water cost increases last year. So it's a growing trend amongst HOAs to say, hey, what can we do to go green? The difficult part that they're running into is as water costs go up, you're trying to be able to justify the expenses to go over to this more natural growth area. And so people want to know when that payback comes. Mm-hmm. But as water increases at the same time, the payback time extends. And so you have to make a selling point where you're saying to people, you're right, the payback period isn't as short as it may have been 5 years ago. However, you have to keep in mind how much more your water would cost had you kept your landscape in the same condition that it was, with a lot of grass.
Mm-hmm. All right.
So it's a growing trend, but there's a happy medium that's difficult to find that both satisfies those that bought a property because there's so much green space, which is another reason people love Racquet Club, is they look at all
this
grass.
It's open space, but like you say, there's more than enough. You know,
we can
plant some islands, you know, dot there with some more islands of native species. Hey, I'd like to see our little community garden expanded instead of being hidden behind the garage. But that's that gets to homeowners who don't like the idea of a community garden out their back deck, right? That visual. They don't want to see that.
The NIMBYs of the Racquet Club.
Yeah, it's interesting. Well, there and others, who think a community garden is unattractive to look at versus things. So isn't that true? You see some pushback there?
Yeah. The difficult part with community gardens is the initial parties that want the community garden are fantastic.
Yeah.
They maintain it.
Lots of enthusiasm.
Looks great. But those people tend to move. And who replaces them are those people also ones that want a community garden. And that's where it becomes really difficult to have those.
Okay. Well, I think we have some fairly enthusiastic folks in our garden. It's a pretty small garden, so there's not a lot of room for a lot of people right now. But it's great. I was in it 1 year. I loved it. I learned a lot.
Yeah.
And so we should have more community gardens around, to take the opportunity to have more community gardens around. All right, a few more minutes.
Yep.
Anything in the area of solid waste management? We have recycling bins and stuff like that.
Yeah, we work with Republic Services quite a bit, who services the Park City area, and we've talked to them about ways we can possibly increase recycling. Racquet Club Village is a unique project for that, but a lot of other areas in Park City, we've been successful in adding recycling dumpsters to properties, as well as the totes that you roll out. So it's something that Republic is more than willing to assist with.
Good.
So long as they can offer the service to the location,
right,
and it's feasible for where that type of material would be stored in terms of the dumpsters or totes.
Mm-hmm. Right, the totes there.
Yeah.
And as long as that they're used properly or they're filled properly.
Right.
Because if Republic Services is getting a lot of contaminated waste, i.e. waste that material that's not recyclable, you know, they have the latitude to probably to come to you and say, like, we're not going to do this anymore. You've got to educate your homeowners about what is and what's not recyclable.
We haven't had a large issue with that. There's been a couple places along Park Avenue where you're near a park and people just throw whatever.
Everything.
There's a dumpster there, so I'm going to throw something in it. And we run into issues there, but it's usually not the residents. The residents are all for it and excited to be able to recycle.
Chris, do you get that sense, like, that your community as a whole is excited about
I do.
Going green.
It's a small sample size, but my local, you know, neighbors in my cul-de-sac, that's a good question, because they all have LED lighting on their porches and stuff. They're all very enthusiastic about filling their recycling bins. A couple have little garden plots right outside their stairs, their entryway, so they're growing a few things there. So there is a lot of that going on. So there is a lot of enthusiasm there in my cul-de-sac. And the people I talk to elsewhere are all for growing less grass and putting in more natural rock and landscaping. So it's a good we're heading in the right direction.
Right.
You see that? All right. Tanner, so where can people go to learn more about PMA or what associations you follow online, property management associations or so, you know, national based associations that people can learn more?
A great element or area people could find out more about running HOAs and being more involved and understanding how their HOA functions, both on the scale of day-to-day operations as well as how can we go green, it's the Utah Community Association Institute, commonly referred to as UKIOA, just from the acronym, but Community Association.
Say that again.
Utah Community Association Institute.
Got it.
It's a great source to educate homeowners on being in an HOA and what processes or steps they would follow if they want to encourage green growth.
What advice would you give to other, you know, property managers here in town who kind of want to get started with these kinds of things, but maybe, you know, haven't had those conversations with their clients?
You know, I would encourage any manager that wanted to go that route and encourage their properties to go green is to get in contact with the necessary parties, whether it's Super Green Solutions or horticulturist, and meet with the board with those parties. Because we can sit there and we can talk about how to be green as much as we want, but until homeowners recognize the process and the steps involved
and the value,
they won't make that decision.
Right. And I'm sorry, when will I be able to put solar panels on my roof?
We are looking at the best options to present to owners for that.
Should you have asked a board member here today as well?
Yes, I should have asked that. That is a question for our board members, but that's an interesting question too going forward. All right, Tanner Blackburn, he's the property, he's with PMA Associates, and we want to thank you again for taking the time.
Thank you for having us.
It's great information, and hopefully we'll see this trend going forward with other HOAs adopting more environmental practices.
I believe we will.
All right. Let's take
Fantastic.
A break. Yeah.
Thanks, Tanner.
Thank you.
Let's take a break. We come back. We've got 4 minutes to kill.
We're going to give you a sneak preview of next week's show.
That's right. That's a good one.
Mm-hmm.
I'll learn what's going to happen too. It's This Great Earth. We'll be right back.
Support for KPCW programming has been provided by the Southern Utah Wilderness Alliance, a nonprofit organization dedicated to protecting Utah's remaining Red Rock Wilderness lands. SUWA and Utah's Red Rock Wilderness need your support now more than ever. To learn more about how you can become involved, please visit the SUWA website at suwa.org.
KPCW programming is supported by Valley Behavioral Health, a nonprofit organization and leading provider of mental and behavioral health services across Summit County. Their Valley Outpatient Clinic provides a full range of services for depression, anxiety, mental illness, trauma, and substance use services for both youth and adults. Information at valleycares.com or at 888-949-4864. Let's deal with it together.
Well, it's time to wrap up another show of This Green Earth. I'm Nell Larson.
I'm Chris Cherniak.
And we're going to give you a sneak preview of what we're going to be talking about next week.
That's right. Brian McInerney from the National Weather Service joins us. He comes in every 3 months or so and talks about all things weather and climate and how things are doing. We haven't spoken to him since March, so he's going to be here to give us a little rundown on how our spring went.
Mm-hmm.
Temperature and precipitation-wise.
How the reservoirs are looking.
How the reservoirs...
There have been some crazy level changes in
really?
The reservoirs, yeah.
Swanner flooded this year?
You know, it's not
as big
wet as I might have thought. So we'll talk about that,
So we'll talk
too.
About that. That's Brian McInerney joining us next week on This Green Earth. We'll also talk with a couple of folks from Park City Municipal about the water quality report they submitted. I got my water quality report a few weeks ago, and I got questions about it. There's lots of it's a great report. It's all good news. It's good news.
no reason to panic.
Yes, no, but lots of questions understanding our water system, where our water comes from, how it's treated, why it's treated.
It's such a complex system here in Park City,
one of the
Summit
most,
County.
It's a good point. One of the most complex in the country. And so Michelle DeHaan and I believe someone else will be here to talk about that in the second half of the show. So that's what's happening next week. We got, one more reminder or a little calendar event coming up. Recycle Utah's Community Cleanup Day on July 22nd. Recycle Utah will hold a Pride in Your Park Community Cleanup Day on Saturday the 22nd. Volunteers can meet at City Park at 9 a.m. to join a crew to pick up trash and recyclables and maybe take all the shoes off those stupid shoe trees.
Gotta leave the shoes.
One tree. You get one tree.
Yeah.
No, that's
right.
A shoe tree. It's not a shoe grove. Okay? It's not a shoe grove. All right. So, they probably won't get around to that, but I'd like to. As anyway, meet at City Park at 9 a.m. On July 22nd and help clean up the city.
Tonight is also Park City Green Drinks, and tonight it will be at the Bill White Farms down toward Kimball Junction from 6 to 8 p.m. And we'll be learning about sustainability and sustainable ag with Bill White Farms.
That's right. Great
mm-hmm.
place.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to learn more about that. Carpool.
Carpool, walk, ride your bike.
Well,
there's a bus stop directly in front of it.
Limited parking. Yes.
Yeah.
So that's Bill White Farms tonight. Hey, we got to wrap up and thank our guests.
That's right. We would like to thank Tanner Blackburn from PMA.
And Ben Holcomb from the Utah Department of Environmental Quality Water Division
Department.
And let's quickly thank our sponsors and who make this show possible. It's Recycle Utah,
Republic Services,
Southern Utah Wilderness Alliance,
Vail Epic Promise,
Berkshire Hathaway Home Services, Utah Properties,
San Francisco Design,
Park City Mountain,
and listeners like you.
Oh, you can email us your thoughts, comments, and ideas at thisgreenearth